Sunday the 12th. She felt bored with newspapers, bored with the whole thing. They were searching for her across those wretched north towns, police and aeroplanes and dogs and sensation seekers. She could only think them idiotic for not believing her letter to Campbell, for trying to say that it was a blind, somebody else had posted it. She was dead. Archie had murdered her. It was silly, and she was bored with it. A woman like her grandmother, she thought, would have worked out days ago what was really going on. She dressed in some of her new clothes and walked the familiar streets. Swan Road, Promenade Crescent, Parliament Street. She went into a church, St. Peter's, and prayed for her mother. Then she walked across West Park, beneath the beech trees and within the edging of the dark grey stone. Those deep, formal, respectable windows. She could dream what was behind them into life. She began to conjure words, lines, ideas. They rose up out of her, and she played with them as she walked. A woman deeply in love, whose fiancé falls hopelessly for a beautiful girl of whom he knows nothing. The woman dreams of killing the girl. I know the story. She offered Fair Rosamond, did she not, the choice of a dagger or a cup of poison? Rosamond chose the poison. Eleanor said nothing. She was white now. Poirot said, but perhaps this time there was to be no choice. A woman whose fiancé marries a rich woman. He plans to kill his wife for her money before returning in triumph to his old love. So I had to come into it too, to look after him. She said it simply but in complete good faith. Poirot had no doubt whatever that her motive had been exactly what she said it was. She herself had not coveted Lynette Doyle's money, but she had loved Simon Doyle, had loved him beyond reason and beyond rectitude and beyond pity. A man with a beautiful young mistress. She begs him to leave his home, even though, as he tells her, his wife loves him too. I said I understood that, but if she loved him, she'd put his happiness first, and at any rate, she wouldn't want to keep him if he wanted to be free. He said, life can't really be solved by admiral maxims out of modern literature. Nature's red in tooth and claw, remember? I said, surely we're all civilized people nowadays. And Amyas laughed. Don't you realize, Elsa, that she's going to suffer? Suffer? Do you know what suffering means? A woman in love with a married man, whose wife has the white-skinned, provocative looks of Nancy Neal. The girl betrays her husband with a lover. The other woman, fresh and pleasant and very English, learns about the affair. She threatens to expose it. She induces the girl to kill herself. Suicide needs a lot of courage. Vivian flinched back as though she had been struck. You've got me there, yes. I've got no pluck. If there were an easy way. There's an easy way in front of you, said Claire. You've only got to run straight down that green slope. A woman on a train with a face like that of a ghost. So many stories. Harlequin's Lane, for instance, in which the woman flung herself into the moonlit pit. And Mr. Satterthwaite, who found the woman's body at the end of the lane, which leads either to love or to death. He had a vista of something at once menacing and terrifying. Joy, sorrow, despair. He knows that he will never now experience these emotions. But I see things, he cried. I may have been only a looker-on at life, but I see things that other people do not. That evening, after dinner, she sat in the Winter Garden ballroom with her head bent to a crossword. The room was emptier than it had been since she arrived. Quiet, calm, soft piano music. The light was dim and forgiving, gleaming low. Perhaps she could live this way forever, without love, without grief. She smiled at Mr. Pettleson as he came across and asked if he might join her for coffee. He had heard that she might be leaving also. Was this true? It had been Mrs. Finley, he thought, who had told him this. She did not know where Mrs. Finley had got that idea. She did not know when she would be leaving. In fact, she had no plans at all. Might he interest her later in a game of billiards? He had heard that she played. Too well for him, no doubt. The band did not play that night, but earlier in the day, two of its members had gone to the police. They suspected, as did other members of staff at the Hydro, that the nice lady who called herself Mrs. Neal was, in fact, Agatha Christie. It was almost over. She smiled at Mr. Pettleson and said that would be delightful. Monday the 13th. Rosie looked at her a little shamefacedly as she brought in breakfast. "Are you all right this morning?" she asked. "Oh, yes, ma'am. Your newspaper as usual, ma'am." 5,000 people had looked for her yesterday. She felt somewhat tired today. A man named Max Pemberton gave his expert theory to the Mail that she was dead. "Should happily I be wrong, then I will bow to her as to a great mistress of a stage drama. But I should still think it very wicked of her to have awakened so much public sympathy in so poor a cause." She felt unusually reluctant to go out. She sat in her room and read for a while. When Rosie came back to do the room, she apologized for being still in her dressing gown. "Always make life easy for servants," her mother had said. Oh, Mummy, what would you have thought of all this? The journalists had gone to try to find her at Ashfield, had walked up to the dear front door and poked around the garden. She should not really have let that happen. Downstairs, the papers were full of the Sunday hunt. Another woman had disappeared, Miss Una Crow. She had walked out of her home in Chelsea and not been seen since. A girl, really, poor thing, suffering from a nervous breakdown after the death of her father. How pitiful it sounded. Meanwhile, it was suggested that she herself was living in London, disguised as a man, like Ethel Lenevre. How ridiculous it all was. She heard a newspaper rustle in the corner of the room. Quite a handsome man. So many people were leaving. She had seen Miss Finley saying goodbye to Miss Corbett, and had felt a certain relief at the thought of no more sidelong looks from Mrs. Finley. Not that she had minded so much. In fact, she would miss the Finleys, their inevitable presence at the corner table of the Winter Garden ballroom. Mrs. Finley guiding her husband in a well-trained waltz, and their daughter's faintly resentful gaucheness. She had enjoyed them. She smiled at the new guest and went out into the streets, hat down, collar down. Tuesday the 14th, and Mrs. Taylor smiling more brightly than ever as she broke off her conversation with Mrs. Robson and said, "Good morning. How well you are looking, Mrs. Neal. Harrogate seems to agree with you." "Are we still going to the dance at the Prospect Hotel tonight?" asked Mrs. Robson. "I do hope so." "Oh, yes, of course." They had discussed this a few evenings ago. Mrs. Robson had suggested it, and she had thought, why not? "Well, do enjoy yourselves, ladies," said Mrs. Taylor. Pleasant, polite, utterly normal. Yet in the Daily Mail, an ex-policeman had written this about her. "One great difficulty is that the search is for a woman with certain attributes that are not common to the ordinary individual. She is talented. She is a woman who, by the very nature of her work, would have an exceptionally elastic brain. Consequently, one would expect her, consciously or subconsciously, to do something extraordinary." Well, that, she thought, was really rather nice. "Soon, some most interesting development must occur, but its nature cannot yet, in my opinion, be even guessed at." She smiled at that. Everything else was more nonsense. On and on it went. How very famous Mrs. Christie had become. How absurd it was when she was here, simply here, as she had told them. They were going to send divers to search all those pools she had driven past. So apparently she was no longer living in London in her musical comedy male impersonator costume. Well, that was good to know. This girl, this Una Crow, she was surely dead. Poor young thing. She had lived at Elm Park Road. How odd. That was just by her friend Nan Watts. Why, they might have passed each other in the street. She went out for a walk through the Valley Gardens today, past the Majestic Hotel, a vast red brick building, unusual for here. She looked at it, at the people inside drinking their morning coffee and smoking, contained within their lives. How lovely it all was. How safe she felt. She enjoyed her lunch. It was quiet in the dining room, and she read some poetry she had taken out from the library. Later she had a massage. Afterwards, she played billiards again. She signed a piece of sheet music for Mr. Pettleson of the song Angels Guard Thee, which he had sung to her piano playing. Teresa Neal, she wrote. He was a charming man, certainly. Perhaps a little smitten with her? A pleasant thought, no more. My dear Mrs. Neal, how very kind. I shall treasure this always. Afterwards she went for her bath and changed for dinner. She put on the georgette dress she had bought when she first arrived. Heavens, more than a week ago now. She glanced at her newspaper again in the darkening room. A woman with certain attributes that are not common to the ordinary individual. She looked out of her window. The sweep of the drive, the road that led to the town, the trees, the stone houses, the fallen light. She looked at herself. Pale hair, pale eyes. She smiled. As she did every night at this time, she walked down the corridor, which creaked a little, then down the short flight of stairs that turned and led to the lobby. Outside the hotel doors, something seemed to be massing in the black air. New arrivals? She went to glance at a copy of the Times. Archie was in the lounge, sitting by the fire. They looked at each other. Archie and Agatha again. She sat down opposite him. Then an extraordinary thing. Mr. Pettleson came up to her with his little bow, and she was saying, "Look, do you see? My brother has arrived." And then suddenly there was a small bustle of activity, and she saw how tired and sad Archie looked, and she knew that she loved him now, always, forever, that she had done this for him, and he was here too late, too late. He was touching her arm to lead her into dinner. "Yes, that is my wife," she heard him say, to the man she had seen in the lounge the day before. The man was talking to her. He was a policeman. A nuisance. What had policemen to do with her? She explained to him that she remembered nothing of what had happened since she left her home 11 days ago. Was it really so long? And that only now was she beginning to regain her memory. "Yes, my wife remembers nothing," said Archie. They were going into dinner together. On the way, she saw Mrs. Robson. Oh, she was so sorry about tonight. My brother has arrived unexpectedly. Would she forgive her? "Of course, Mrs. Neal. How very nice for you." They sat, Archie again opposite her at the table. How white his face was. But could it not now be just all right? The menu, the food, perhaps even a glass of table wine. "How was Teddy?" she asked. She knew nothing about any of it, he said, so she was perfectly all right. "Missing me?" At that moment, the waiter came up, and he turned his head away to give their order. "Are you all right, Agatha?" he said when he had finished. "I don't know," she said. "Am I?" He looked at her. She had gone away, but she knew that it was he who eluded her, then, now, and forever. She had grown up at last. But 10 slow mornings passed, and on the 11th, her father laid the letter in her hand, and closed the hand upon it, and she died. She smiled at the waiter, and began to eat. From that point on, she became public property. The journalists poured into the Harrogate Hydro. Mr. and Mrs. Taylor were powerless against them. Agatha was what the press wanted, but she had gone up to her room after dinner. Archie, who had taken a separate room for himself, was left to cope. Although he wished to say nothing, he took the advice of Superintendent McDowell of the West Riding Police, the man who had spoken to Agatha before she went in to dinner, and agreed to speak to one newspaper. In a statement to the Yorkshire Post, Archie put forward for the first time the official line on Agatha's disappearance, which for many years her family stuck to resolutely. "There is no question about her identity. She is my wife. She is suffering from complete loss of memory and identity. She does not know who she is. She does not know me, and she does not know why she is in Harrogate. I am hoping to take her to London tomorrow to see a doctor and a specialist, and I hope that rest and quiet will put her right. Great credit is due to the police for their untiring efforts in the matter, and for the inquiries which have led to her discovery." The idea that this would put an end to speculation is, in retrospect, almost comical. But Archie did not have a clue about what he was doing, what he had become mixed up in. He could only dimly understand the mysterious motives of a wife who was, as he told the Daily Mail, very clever, far cleverer than himself. He had been through pretty good hell during the past week or so, suspected of adultery at best and murder at worst, and his relief that it was over was complicated by anger, anxiety, and guilt. As always, his instinct was to bury his feelings. It was a good idea, but he did not do it very well. He held himself on a rein so tight it was always liable to snap, and the reporters knew it. He had something to hide. Mrs. Neal, indeed. They knew all about what that meant. If Archie was covering up for his wife, he was also covering up for himself. After giving the statement, Archie sent a telegram to Charlotte Fisher at Stiles. He suggested that she arrange for his delage to be driven from Sunningdale to King's Cross, where he and Agatha could pick it up before going home. Charlotte had been rung at around midday by the Surrey police, who gave her news of the possible sighting that they had received from Yorkshire. She was asked to travel to Harrogate, but could not go, as Rosalind was in her care. Instead, she contacted Archie at his office, and he called the 1:40 from King's Cross, the same train that Agatha had taken. Charlotte, too, had gone through hell. She had been under a certain degree of suspicion, not just that she knew more than she was telling, but that, for some unknown motive, she had murdered her employer. Reporters had clustered round Stiles, lurking beneath the little black windows, taking her photograph every time she emerged. For support, she had had her sister Mary stay with her, and between them they had looked after Rosalind. Under intense pressure, Charlotte's loyalty to Agatha had remained absolute. Now she rang family and friends, giving them the official amnesia line. Meanwhile, Archie changed his mind about the arrangements for getting Agatha away from Harrogate. It was obvious they could not catch a train to London tomorrow, then go on to Sunningdale. The journalists would simply follow them and camp outside the house. So he contacted Madge and James Watts and made a new arrangement. The pretense would be maintained that the Christies were going to Stiles. At Leeds, they would change trains and travel to Abney. There, Agatha could hole up. No reporter could get past those vast iron gates. Accordingly, the Wattses arrived at the Hydro early on Wednesday morning, where they were met by Archie. Madge had known absolutely nothing of Agatha's thoughts before she had left her home on 3rd of December, although she might have made a better guess than most at her sister's state of mind. James, who was fond of Agatha and a practical, competent man, took charge of the arrangements to get her away. At around 9:15 a.m., Agatha left the hotel that had been her home for 10 days. How reluctant she must have been to drag herself back from the forgetful depths. The sheer number of journalists made escape very difficult, so a decoy car had been arranged, a landaulet, which drew up at the entrance and attracted a crush of photographers. Meanwhile, a taxi had arrived at the goods entrance around the side. The mail, having guessed the ruse, was there to take a picture of Agatha as she walked down the few steps to the car. Beneath the brim of her hat, Her face was entirely blank. At Harrogate Station, she again used the goods entrance. There were too many people on the platform for the journalists to identify Agatha with certainty. She and Madge managed to hide in their compartment, taken for Mr. Parker's party, while their husbands kept discreet watch outside. Meanwhile, some reporters were running across the tracks to reach the King's Cross train. At Leeds, the whole performance was repeated, when it was realized that Agatha was changing trains rather than going on to London. Her photograph was taken by many of the newspapers, as, smiling bizarrely, she led the way towards the Manchester train. By the time it arrived, a vast crowd of journalists had amassed to meet them. Archie lost control briefly when he pushed away a man who tried to talk to Agatha, saying, "This lady is ill." Madge's chauffeur-driven Wolseley was waiting outside the station, and more photographs were taken as Agatha got into it. Again, she was smiling. She also appeared to be wearing her wedding ring. A convoy of press chased the Wolseley all the way to Abney Hall, where the gates were padlocked. The crowd at King's Cross, waiting for the arrival of the Harrogate train, sighed and shoved as Agatha failed to appear. Then the train driver shouted, "We have not got her!" And they went home disappointed, clutching their newspapers, talking of Mrs. Christie. Something of the mystery will always remain. The blank face of the quarry will never give up all its secrets. The facts may now be known, and much of the intention behind them, but in the end, what is left is a story. A mystery story. Her finest, because it cannot be solved. Of course, there have been many attempts to do so, but these fail because the mystery Agatha created was so much more than merely a puzzle. Questions can be asked. Did she plan it all? Did she lose her memory? Was it a publicity stunt? Was she after revenge or pity or an end to it all? Indeed, these questions have been asked repeatedly in the hope of a simple answer. But such a hope is not relevant. It is reductive. Her 11 days in the wilderness are a myth, a poem. They exist in a different sphere from that of theories and solutions. The 11 days are the creation of an artist, a writer, and writers live life differently. Their motives are always mixed, because to them everything is a story. That is their escape, their freedom. That is their way. But because the story is that of Agatha Christie, the temptation has been to treat it as a detective story, to work it out. Oh, for Poirot, somebody who could simply take the facts, the letters, the abandoned car, the train journeys, the Times advertisement, and by a miracle of reasoning, make them cohere. In a sense, they do cohere. As has been shown, there is a solution that clears the tangle from the forest. But it can only do so in honesty by acknowledging the dark areas, the ambivalences, the unknowable. Agatha herself barely understood what she had done throughout those 11 days. How, then, can they be rendered except as a story? All biography is storytelling. No life is a code to be deciphered. There will always be gaps and inconsistencies, and it is stories that make the missing connections. Omniscience is for Hercule Poirot. Real life knows less. It has the beauty of mystery, and this, despite the books that she wrote, was something that Agatha understood very well. She must have known she had created a puzzle of a different order, with all the geometric complexity of Roger Ackroyd. How to work it out? Turn it this way, that way? And yet, with this twist in the tale, it was true, and therefore it could never be solved. It was perfect, in fact. The perfect metaphor for human mystery. What could be more impenetrable than the woman who moved through Harrogate like a smiling ghost, reading newspaper reports about her own vanished self? And so the story endures, infinitely fascinating, and those who would lay it to rest, who would destroy its beauty by solving it, are defeated at every turn. Perhaps the best comment of all was written on the 16th of December, 2 days after Agatha had been found at Harrogate, when the newspapers were still simmering about the affair and the faintly foolish part they had played in it. It came from a columnist in the Daily Sketch, who wrote as the man in the street. Many citizens, who, like me, have neither met Mrs. Agatha Christie nor read any of her novels, must have felt immensely relieved when the police at last ascertained her new address. Whether such facts as were available regarding this matter from the start ever justified the subsequent efforts at fiction in which so many people indulged, not to mention the resulting impressive expenditure of energy and money, is a little doubtful. Shortly after Mrs. Christie had left home, a letter from her was received by a brother of Colonel Christie, stating that she was in ill health and was going to a Yorkshire spa, which apparently is precisely what she did. So all that can be said now is that various people have had a good run for someone else's money. This is the sublime joke about the Agatha Christie disappearance. Separate the intention from the effect, and it is clear that there was no disappearance, at least not an intentional one. Certainly there was never any intention to disappear for 11 days. It just looked that way to the people who were searching so hard for Agatha. They were blind to the fact that she had told them where she was. As the man in the street so unarguably put it, Agatha did exactly what she had said she was going to do, and more fooled the police and the press for not having believed her. So here, in plain text, is Agatha's story. She drove away from Stiles with the vague intention of looking for Archie, or killing herself, or both. She then drifted into a highly particular state of mind. She was in command of herself to the extent that she could plan and think and function, and yet the self that she commanded was no longer really there. She had not killed herself, yet in a sense she had died. This ghost, Agatha created, her pathetic faux puzzle of the abandoned car overhanging the quarry, the case, the driving license, the fur coat, the clues. And she sought to do the one thing that might reclaim her husband. She absconded, in the belief that giving Archie a weekend of agony, making him fear that she was dead, awakening his buried feelings, might restore him to her. She appealed to the one person who could intercede on her behalf, her brother-in-law, and told him that she was going away to Yorkshire, making it plain that she was unwell and unhappy. Her hope was that Campbell would receive her letter on Monday, 6th of December, get in touch with Archie, and make him go and find her. Mrs. Neal was another clue, both a sign of her presence and a prick to Archie's conscience. Yet to explicate is, in the end, to confuse. What Agatha did made sense, and yet it made no sense. That is why the two most familiar solutions to the disappearance are not just wrong, they are meaningless. Agatha did not lose her memory, as the official line had it for many years, nor did she plan a setup, as certain commentators have cynically insisted. The truth lies somewhere between those two theories, in the realm of ambiguity, in limbo. Like the consciousness of its creator, whose identity slipped away into the dark sky as she walked down to the quarry. But of course, it was not only Agatha who wrote the story of her disappearance. Alongside her version was the far more familiar one created by the police and the press. There were two stories, in fact, the private and the public, and in the divergence between them lies infinite fascination. Agatha drifted silently beneath the beech trees, while, as it were in another universe, the busy people of England pondered her fate. She always saw the story as a private one, right up to the moment that she was found at the Harrogate Hydro. Considering how famous her name was to become, it is hard to realize how little known it was at the start of these events. The Daily Mail of 6th of December referred to the disappearance of a woman novelist, a writer of detective stories, including Who Killed Aykroyd. She was an entirely private person, and even in her right mind, she would never have dreamed that her actions would become public property. Thus it was that she believed she could abandon a car over a quarry and cause serious alarm to just one person, her husband. The idea that her behavior might reverberate beyond her own circle would simply not have occurred to her. She was not that kind of person. Nor would it have reverberated, at least not to the extent that it did, had it not been for the attitude of the police, or, to be precise, the attitude of Deputy Chief Constable Kenwood of the Surrey Constabulary, a man who fell in love with his theory about the case, and with the attentions of the journalist who wanted to hear it. It was around 11 a.m. on Saturday, 4th of December, when Kenwood first learned that a car, established as Agatha's property by the driving license left inside it, had been found at Newlands Corner. In an interview given after the event to the Surrey Advertiser, Kenwood said, "It seemed probable that the occupant or occupants had met with disaster." As Agatha lived in Sunningdale, the Berkshire Constabulary was informed, and the two forces were then obliged to work together. Therein lay a difficulty. From the first, Deputy Chief Constable Kenwood was convinced that Agatha was dead and that her body lay near the site of her car. Superintendent Goddard of Berkshire was equally certain that she was alive. Goddard was a sensible man, whose instinct told him that an emotional upheaval had caused Agatha to take flight. Shorn of complications, this was pretty much what had happened. However, chief responsibility for the case lay with Surrey, so Kenwood's will prevailed. The case of Agatha's disappearance, which could have been handled with tact and intelligence, became wildly overblown. A focus for nationwide publicity, extensive press involvement, and numerous searches of the area around Newlands Corner. Obviously, Kenwood was sincere in his belief that Agatha was dead, but the less likely it became that her body would be found in the environs of her car, the more dogged he became in his desire to be proved right. "What have I always told you? Everything must be taken into account. If the fact will not fit the theory, let the theory go." The words of Poirot in The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. But Kenwood, like most people with ideas about this case, ignored them. Rather, as in the investigation of the Yorkshire Ripper murders, which in the late 1970s became fixated upon a hoax tape recording and thus missed the culprit as he passed repeatedly through police interview rooms, Kenwood went in such single-minded pursuit of his own ideas that he ignored the one real clue to Agatha's whereabouts. It was the clear duty of the police, from the point of view of humanity alone, to endeavour to find Mrs. Christie if she was wandering about, out of her mind, because of nervous collapse in the woods or surroundings of Newlands Corner, said Kenwood to the Surrey Advertiser. Having failed in this direction, it was again the duty of the police to satisfy themselves that it was not a matter of foul play, and that no crime had been committed. This was the nub of it. Kenwood believed there was a strong possibility that Agatha had been murdered by her husband. That was why he failed to pursue the clue of the letter that had been sent to Campbell Christie. Instead of taking its contents at face value and accepting that its postmark, 9:45 a.m., London Southwest 1, almost certainly proved that Agatha had been alive on Saturday morning, he clung to his own theory. He decided that the letter had either not been posted by Agatha herself, or that she had posted it in London before returning to Newlands Corner. There was, therefore, insufficient investigation of Agatha's statement that she was going to a Yorkshire spa. The problem was that the letter had been destroyed, although its envelope had not, and there was only Campbell's word for its contents. Kenwood might have believed that Campbell was shielding his brother by lying about what was in the letter, or he might have thought that Archie himself had posted it. From quite early on, the newspapers knew what was in Kenwood's mind. They sensed that he was itching to cuff the hands of that arrogant Colonel Christie. Several other theories were put forward in their pages, but it was the possibility of wife murder that kept the story bubbling so fiercely. It has led some commentators to suggest that Agatha had wanted Archie to be suspected or even arrested. This is an entirely absurd notion. Agatha was trying to get her husband back, not to alienate him forever. But in order to see this, it is again necessary to separate intention from effect. Agatha meant no such thing to happen to Archie. Nevertheless, it became a very real possibility. As one of the journalists who reported on the case, Richie Calder of the Daily News, later wrote, "If her body had been found in the silent pool, say, I have no doubt from what I knew of the police attitude that Colonel Christie would have been held on circumstantial evidence." So it was that because of Kenwood in the first instance, then because of the newspapers, Agatha's private story became public. The police and the press were entangled in a folie à deux, which led to a deeply personal crisis becoming the property of the nation. Anyone who believes that an intrusive and judgmental media is a recent phenomenon should look at the reports of Agatha's disappearance. Back in 1926, newspapers were making exactly the same assumptions about the hunger of their readers for sensation, disaster, and scandal. But the press cannot really be blamed. The bones that Kenwood held out were too juicy to resist. It was, and remains, a cracking story. It started quite small, on Monday, 6th of December, alongside news of the death of Claude Monet. By the next day, it was the stuff of headlines. It was reported with a decent level of accuracy, which would later be compromised, as newspapers became competitive and claimed exclusive information for themselves. On Tuesday the 7th, however, certain facts were established. Agatha's Morris had been found at Newlands Corner, a vast expanse of the North Downs that stretches away from the A25, near Guildford, towards the village of Albury. The car was found about 300 yards down the hill, at the edge of a quarry, with its bonnet jammed in a bush. It was close to one of the paths, now called a byway, that leads from the top of Newlands Corner. About halfway down this path becomes a rutted track, Water Lane, which passes to the left of the quarry, then leads down towards Albury. The car was seen on Saturday, 4th of December, by a gypsy boy named Best, who had been walking along Albury's main street at around 8 a.m. In 1926, Newlands Corner was far more open than it is today. There was no barrier, as there is now, between the main road and the sloping grassland, and drivers did occasionally career off onto the downs. A good many trees are now planted across the hills, but there was little then to impede a car's descent. Nevertheless, Agatha's car was a long way down, and as there were no signs of the brakes having been applied, it seemed unlikely that she had skidded there by accident. A little after 8, a man named Frederick Dorr, who worked with cars, examined the Morris more closely. According to most reports, he found it with a flat battery and the brakes off. He was variously quoted as to how the car had got there. In the Surrey Advertiser, he said it was as though the car had been allowed to run down the hill. And in the Daily Sketch, more strongly, it appeared to me that it must have been given a push at the top of the hill. But the car had suffered very little damage, considering its extraordinary position, and was later capable of being driven to a garage on the Epsom Road. It contained around 2 gallons of petrol, also Agatha's dressing case, some items of clothing including a fur coat, and an out-of-date driving license. In some reports, Dorr also made reference to a gypsy girl, whom he met nearby on Saturday morning, who said that she had heard a car at about midnight being driven along the top of Newlands Corner. He walked up the hill to the refreshment kiosk run by Mr. Alfred Lewland, who was given charge of the car, while Dorr went to the nearby Newlands Corner Hotel to telephone the police. Lewland told the Daily News that he was certain the brakes were on, adding that it was difficult to see how it managed to run down the hill. The newspapers also reported a sighting of Agatha herself. Early in the investigation, a man came forward to say that he had started a car at around 6:20 a.m. on Saturday the 4th, near Newlands Corner, for a woman answering her description. This man was named first as Ernest Cross, then as Edward McAllister. A discrepancy that was never resolved, and there were inevitable deviations within the reporting of his story. The Daily Express described the woman he had helped as having hoar frost in her hair and putting her hands to her head as if in distress. The Surrey Advertiser, who talked to McAllister direct and whose reporting was generally excellent, wrote that the woman did not seem distraught or particularly distressed, but seemed a little strange, which he put down to the worry of the car. It was indeed almost as though there were two different men involved, since Cross described the car radiator as quite hot and square-shaped. Agatha's Morris had a bull-nosed radiator, while McAllister stated that it was stone-cold. In every report, the woman is said to have worn no hat or coat, and to have driven off in a direction away from Newland's Corner. At this point, the newspaper reports would have caused readers to believe that Agatha had killed herself. "Hatless woman met on the downs" was the headline in the Express, giving an impression of a semi-dressed lunatic who had wandered through the night to her doom. Emphasis was given to the proximity of the abandoned car to the silent pool, which the police were draining, and which was described, rightly, as an extremely creepy place. From the first, and not just because of what Agatha did for a living, the case was treated as a dark and sinister mystery. The big story on Wednesday, the 8th, was the letter that Agatha had sent to Campbell Christie. "Said she was going for weekend visit to a Yorkshire spa," was the headline in the Daily Sketch. Then dismissively, "No evidence that she went there." How could the story have so simple a solution? With regard to the Southwest 1 postmark, which also presented a threat to the corpse at Newland's Corner scenario, it was suggested that Agatha might not have posted the letter herself, or that she might somehow have arranged for its posting when she stayed at her club, the Forum, on the night of 1st of December. How and by whom it was posted in London is a question that has not yet been elucidated, wrote the Surrey Advertiser. Never was there any suggestion that the letter might be taken at face value. It was merely another snort of a drug to which police and press had become quickly addicted. For example, it was reported that Agatha had visited her local chemist in the past couple of weeks to get sleeping pills, and that she had had a conversation with him about the poison hyoscine, saying, "I should never commit suicide by violent means when there is such a drug as hyoscine available." Some of the papers also stated that Agatha might have been in possession of a revolver. But although the strong implication was that Agatha was dead, the newspapers also printed reports of several sightings. Most of these were in the area of Newland's Corner. Mrs. Kitching, who lived near Albury, had met a strange woman on the road at noon on Saturday, whom she was convinced was Mrs. Christie. A cowman had seen her car at about 4 a.m. on Saturday the 4th, driving through the nearby village of Shear. A Mr. Brown offered her a lift at about 11:15 a.m. on the same day. She seemed to be in the kind of mood when she did not care what happened. And a Mr. Richards reported seeing her on Saturday afternoon in a parked car up a lane a few miles from Guildford, with a man sitting beside her. On Monday, Agatha was seen in Plumstead, southeast London, when she burst into the house of a Mr. Daniels waving a pound note and demanded change. On Tuesday, she was seen by a Mrs. Bishop boarding a bus at Piccadilly and alighting at Bayswater, in a very distressed condition. Meanwhile, on Wednesday the 8th, the Harrogate Herald printed its weekly list of visitors to the town. The name of Mrs. Neal, Cape Town, appeared as a guest at the Harrogate Hydro. The police had, of course, taken some note of Agatha's letter to Campbell. A small paragraph in the Daily Express of 9th of December referred to them making careful inquiries in Harrogate. It was reported that an unknown woman, about the same age as Mrs. Christie, went to the Royal Baths yesterday, the one true sighting among the mass of false ones. Journalists from the Express and the Daily Chronicle did the rounds of the Harrogate hotels, but finding no woman registered under Agatha's name, concluded that she was not there. Yet the clue that might have found her was published on the 9th, with the first mention of Miss Neild, as the Westminster Gazette called her, the only other person at the house at Godalming, where Archie had spent the previous weekend. There were also reports of police interviews with the Christie's household staff. "I understand," wrote the Gazette's special correspondent, "that there is no truth in the rumour that there were high words between them at the breakfast table." In other words, the special correspondent believed that there had been high words, and had a pretty good idea as to what those words had been about. The press had the scent by now. They knew what Kenwood thought about Archie, and they knew why he thought it. The story had acquired a luscious new dimension. Having been an object of considerable pity, driven to distraction by the mystery, as the Mail wrote on the 7th, Archie was becoming more like an object of suspicion. He had requested and obtained a police guard at Stiles in order to protect both himself and his daughter, a policeman accompanied Rosalind to school every day, from the jabbering attentions of the press. Yet he was unable to resist talking to them. "I am in a bad state of health," he told the Daily Express, "and suffering from the anxiety caused by the continued lack of news. Frankly, I cannot stand it much longer." To the Evening News he said even more. "I left home on Friday to spend the weekend with friends. Where I stayed, I am not prepared to state. I have told the police. I do not want my friends to be dragged into this. It is my business alone. I have been badgered and pestered like a criminal, and all I want is to be left alone." The next day, the 10th, brought extensive reports and photographs of the searches for Agatha at Newlands Corner. 500 police search for Mrs. Christie was the headline in the Daily Mail. Less sensationally, the Times reported that nearly 250 police had taken part in the search, assisted by volunteers, including Archie Christie. With him was Agatha's dog Peter, or Patsy, as some of the papers called him. Two civilian aeroplanes were used to scour the area. Earlier in the week, Albury Mill Pond had been drained, and the beagles of the Guildford and Shear Hunt had been used by Kenwood as an unofficial search party. Nothing had been found, except for a hoax message dutifully reported in the papers, which read, "Ask Candle Lanch. He knows more about the Silent Pool than..." But the big news, on the 10th of December, were the words of Archie Christie, who had given in and talked extensively to the newspapers. The Mail quoted him at length. Doubtless encouraged by the sympathetic demeanour of yet another special correspondent, he revealed something of his thoughts, not just about the disappearance, but about Agatha herself. He did not lack understanding of her nature. He knew that her mind worked in unusual ways. Nevertheless, the theories he put forward were deeply coloured by the desire to cover his own tracks. To this end, he said that Agatha had discussed the possibility of disappearing at will. "Some time ago," she told her sister, "I could disappear if I wished, and set about it carefully." They were discussing something that appeared in the papers, I think. That shows that the possibility of engineering a disappearance had been running through her mind, probably for the purpose of her work. Personally, I feel that is what happened. At any rate, I am buoying myself up with that belief. Archie went on to give his reasons as to why he did not believe Agatha had committed suicide. "She would have used poison," he said, "had she done such a thing. And anyway, if a person intends to end his life, he does not take the trouble to go miles away and then remove a heavy coat and walk off into the blue before doing it. I think she walked down the hill and off God knows where. I suggest she walked down the hill because she always hated walking uphill." Some of this was amazingly near the mark, especially the passage about walking downhill. Archie's motive for saying it, however, was affected by self-interest. He wanted to emphasize that Agatha was still alive because her only credible reason for killing herself was his relationship with Nancy Neal. He gave details of the last 3 days before Agatha had disappeared, including the visit to Edmund Cork in London. It is surprising, in the light of their estrangement, how much he knew about the progress of Agatha's writing. Obviously, they had maintained some sort of relationship, or perhaps it was simply that Agatha had pretended to carry on with him as normal. "She told me that they had been talking about her new novel, The Mystery of the Blue Train, which she could not complete, I think she was also rather worried about turning another series of hers, The Big Four, into book form. It did not, however, appear to affect her, for after dinner on Thursday evening she went off with her secretary, Miss Fisher, to a dancing class or something at Ascot. This was all very interesting, but the point of the interview lay elsewhere. I directed Colonel Christie's attention to certain rumours which have gained currency in Sunningdale and elsewhere. Archie strenuously denied that there had been a row between him and Agatha on the morning of Friday the 3rd. She was perfectly well, that is to say, as well as she had been for months past. She knew I was going away for the weekend. She knew who were going to be the members of the little party at the house at which I was going to stay, and neither then or at any time did she raise the slightest objection. I strongly deprecate introducing any tittle-tattle into this matter. That will not help me to find my wife, which is what I want to do. My wife has never made the slightest objection to any of my friends, all of whom she knew. How badly this reads. How much wiser Archie would have been to say nothing. Yet he would not be the last person to be seduced by the press into explaining himself. People with infinitely greater media awareness have been convinced that silence is more liable to misinterpretation than words. Only clever, watchful Charlotte knew that Archie was doing the wrong thing. It was not the job of the journalists to exonerate him. Their loyalty was solely to the story, and the best story of all was Archie's guilt. One reporter, Stanley Bishop, of the Daily Express, was absolutely convinced that this was a case of uxoricide. Richie Calder theorized that Archie had left the James's house in the middle of the night, met Agatha at Newland's Corner, and killed her. As the 1922 trial of Edith Thompson had shown, the English public was willing to condemn an adulterer for murder, however shaky the proof. Evidence against Archie was non-existent, but his character had been similarly blackened. Even if he had not actually murdered his wife, the press believed that he had probably driven her to suicide. So he should not have talked. But perhaps because he was innocent of the greater crime, and because he was sure, knowing her as he did, that Agatha was alive, his instinct was to defend himself. In truth, Archie could not believe the situation in which he had been placed. He was the type of man to think that journalists and policemen belonged to a different caste, and now here he was, at the centre of both a headline story and a possible criminal investigation. The cosy comfort of his weekend with Nancy, relaxation, respite, golf, Madge and Sam playing happily with their new baby, had been shattered by the calm voice of Charlotte. Possibly he knew then that life would never be the same again for any of them. Reports differ on whether Charlotte contacted Archie on Friday night when she returned to Stiles from London or on Saturday morning after Agatha's car had been found. According to Richie Calder's recollections, by no means error-free, it was on Friday that Charlotte, whether at Mrs. Christie's suggestion or because she was in a panic, telephoned to warn Archie that Agatha had gone missing. A dinner party was in progress, wrote Calder. What the household described as an engagement party for Colonel Christie and Miss Neal. This was gossip from the servants, relayed to the press via the police. It is unsustained, but it helps to explain the attitude towards Archie. It also backed the theory that Archie had left the Jameses that night, driven to meet Agatha nearby, and murdered her. But none of this is clear, as other reports have Charlotte telephoning Archie on Saturday morning, when he returned to Stiles and met the police. Nancy, meanwhile, had retreated into the fastness of her parents' house in Hertfordshire, where Archie prayed she would remain undisturbed, if only Agatha could be found before Nancy's name was known. It was a mercy that Charlotte was so discreet, although the servants could not be similarly trusted. Charlotte remained self-possessed, even when the police threw the occasional dart of suspicion her way. She and her sister Mary moved in their dignified Edinburgh way about the house, keeping things organized, keeping them normal. Charlotte dealt beautifully with Rosalind, who had been told that her mother was away writing a book. She dealt with Madge Watts, who believed that somebody must have an idea of what had happened to her sister. She dealt with the constant telephone calls and with the press who lurked outside the house. They knew that they would get little change from Miss Fisher, however hard they tried. Archie was a different matter. In his 10th of December Daily Mail interview, he had yet more to say about what Agatha might have done. "I only know what I have been told by the servants. I imagine, however, that she got into such a state that she could not sit down quietly to read or work. I have got into that state myself many a time, and have gone out for a walk just aimlessly. That, I think, is what my wife did. But instead of walking, she took the car, a four-seater, and drove off. The servants did not notice anything particularly strange about her, and when Miss Fisher, who had gone to London, rang up in the evening to see if she was wanted, my wife was all right. She left a note addressed to Miss Fisher in which she asked for the arrangements for the Yorkshire visit that weekend to Beverley to be cancelled, adding that she was going for a run round and would let her know on the morrow where she was. That is all I know, and I need hardly tell you that the suspense of the uncertainty is terrible." The letter that Agatha had written to Charlotte was in the possession of the police by this time. There was also the letter that Agatha had left for Archie, which he had burned before anybody else could read it. Almost certainly it made reference to his relationship with Nancy Neal, although not according to the Daily Mail of the 11th of December, which had Archie's own assurances as to the letter's contents. "They have nothing whatever to do with my wife's disappearance," he explained. "It was certainly not a goodbye letter, nor did it make the slightest complaint. It was a note which, I am sure, my wife wrote when she recalled something she wanted to tell me long before the impulse overtook her to go out in the car." Not surprisingly, Kenwood took a somewhat different view of Agatha's letter to her husband. Obviously, Archie himself would not have told Kenwood about the letter. It is possible that Charlotte did so, but far more likely it was one of the maids who would have seen it in the hall. Subsequently, there was a conference between the Surrey and Berkshire forces at Bagshot Police Station, in the course of which the discovery of the new letter was discussed, wrote the Daily Sketch. The newspapers also pondered the contents of the letter left for Charlotte, which Archie discussed with the Mail in his by now customary fashion, the one that led readers to believe precisely the opposite of what he said. "It had nothing whatever to do with my wife's disappearance. It certainly made no allegations against anyone." Clearly thinking it would help his cause, he went on to say that he and Agatha did not quarrel about our individual friends or anything else. "You must remember that we have been married for some years, and like other married couples, led to a certain extent our own lives." Some of the 11th of December newspapers would have made uncomfortable reading for Archie. The Sketch informed its readers that Colonel Christie was today invited to call upon Deputy Chief Constable Kenwood in order to discuss the letter that he had destroyed. The Westminster Gazette wrote that important developments were pending as a result of the Bagshot conference and described Archie as showing signs of anxiety when he left his meeting with Kenwood. The averagely astute reader might well have thought an arrest was imminent. However, the Express took a different tack, stating that the police now believed Agatha to be alive. Certainly, this was true of the Berkshire force. Meanwhile, the reporters had inevitably been badgering the James's household in Godalming. The Mail had managed to get a somewhat fractious interview with Sam James, whose loyalty to Archie read unsympathetically. "Suggestions have been made that Colonel Christie was called up by his wife while he was here, or that he went out to meet his wife, or that she came here to meet him. Nothing of that kind happened. I believe that Mrs. Christie returned home and found that the Colonel was spending the weekend with us, and that she then drove off in a fit of pique." This was not the general belief, although the Daily News printed three doctored photographs purporting to show Agatha in possible disguises, and although there were new rumours that she was in a South Coast hotel, or possibly in Rhyl, it was Kenwood's theory that held popular sway.